Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
A listener has texted us to say that their family had scabies during lockdown. It was horrific. So that's a little while ago. But it took us 2 years, they say, to get fully free of them. It cost us a fortune in treatment. And our mental health really suffered. My children had scars and marks for a long time afterwards. And we will never forget it. Well, they're on the rise again. So we all need to watch out for them. But there's nothing, as Dr. Phil was saying there, there's nothing really you can do to prevent it. You know, you can't really take any measures to avoid it if it is coming for you. But the treatments are there, they are available. If the over-the-counter ones don't work, that's when you go to the GP for advice. But there's a good few steps to it, as he was telling us there. And now, any of us who have sat around a hearth or a campfire will know how mesmerising the flickering flames can be to stare at. Fire is both a vital tool and a powerful force of destruction. But what is it? What is fire? How does it ignite? What keeps it burning? Well, here to tell us more about the science behind the flames and how understanding fire can help us harness and control it safely, I'm joined in the studio by physicist Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Shane, good to have you with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm delighted that we're looking at something that we all take for granted and examining it and asking questions about it. It's a great idea. So when we see a flame, what are we looking at?
I have to be very careful here. My brother is a fire officer in Kildare. So when I told him I was coming to talk to you about fire, he was like, what? You guys, it's the one area of science in the family that he's experts in. But so I ran.
Should have had him in with us.
Indeed. But I find fire absolutely intoxicating to look at. You know, when you're when you have the telly off for some reason and you might have the fire going, it's so easy just to stare into the flame as it changes so rapidly, and the colours and the flicker of the flame is it draws us in, right? But what we're actually looking at is a very complex chemical reaction. And it's fundamental, right, when we think about our use of fire and our capacity to control it. But what we're looking at is taking a fuel, something that we can burn, and adding an initial heat, and in the presence of oxygen in the air, turning that into energy. Mm-hmm. So heat and light, and perhaps some other products like soot or ash that might come out. But it is that kind of chemical reaction. It's irreversible, of transforming, say, a piece of coal or a piece of wax or a piece of wood into heat and light.
Right.
And
well, tell us more about the chemical reaction then.
Yeah, well, what's important here are these three components. You need the fuel, you need something that will burn, and you need oxygen. You need the gas to keep that reaction going. And of course, you need an initial spark. Fire, there's no such thing as spontaneous combustion, really. You always have to add some degree of ignition to get it going. If you take a simple example, right, something like a petroleum product, right? Effectively, that's what our engines run on in the old-fashioned cars, is a controlled explosion, right? If you were to write the risk audit for a car in 2025, I suspect they'd never allow you make one, because you're taking a highly combustible liquid and you're setting it alight. And mm-hmm. you're using that controlled explosion to drive an engine. And if you take something like octane, right, you hear of high octane fuel, there's 8 carbon atoms, hence the name octane. And they're all joined in a linear chain. And each carbon has kind of a hydrogen frill around the edge. And so far, so good. You can dig this up out of the ground and you can refine it. Now, if you add a spark, say from a spark plug, and you do it in an oxygen-rich environment, like the air that we breathe, then you're able to split open those carbon chains. So you're literally cracking open the carbon molecule or the carbon chains, and the individual carbon atoms then react with the oxygen, and they make carbon dioxide. The hydrogen frills react with the oxygen too, and you get water. So that's the simple equation, mm-hmm. is that you're going from a chain of carbon, and you're mixing in oxygen with an initial spark, and you're turning it into carbon dioxide and water. But the other thing you get is the pent up energy, the latent energy in the carbon chain, and that turns into the heat and light. And if you can control it, you can warm your house, you can power a power station, or you can drive an engine. But you create carbon dioxide, and as we all know, that ain't going anywhere.
Yeah.
It just goes into our atmosphere, or it acidifies the ocean, and it's very hard to get rid of it.
Yeah, we think of oxygen, of course, as the gas of life. You know, it's all around us, but it can have radical effects on other elements, can't it?
Yeah, radical is the good word when you think of oxygen. Oxygen is the mean element, right? It's one of my favourites in the periodic table because it is a disruptor. It is a radical. It comes in and it will disrupt happy chemical setups. It'll tear things apart and it'll insist on a new order with it in the middle of things, right? So it's an aggressive element, but it is essential. That's why we breathe oxygen. So we breathe oxygen in order for us to split open the glucose sugars that are in our foods. And at a cellular level, that drives our bodies. It literally keeps us alive. And when it comes to a more simple things like setting something on fire, it does the same thing. So it takes these carbon chains and it chops them up to release the energy from the chain and insert itself with the carbon to make carbon dioxide.
Olivia would like to know, she just sent us a text, thank you Olivia, what makes a flame go out when you blow it? Is it a lack of oxygen or a break in the fuel supply?
Well, that's a great question, yeah. I suspect it's a combination of things, but Lydia might be thinking of a candle, right? So you blow out a candle and what you're doing, so candles are fascinating, right? If you think about the simple science behind a candle, you have a wick that's surrounded by wax. When you add the initial spark with your matches, you're setting the wick alight and it melts the wax. The wax turns into a gas and that gas is flammable and that gas burns. So that's why the wax will eventually disappear. But if you cut out the flame from the gas or from the wick, you're extinguishing the reaction. So you're taking out the initial heat to drive that reaction. And candles are absolutely fascinating when you think about how simple they are, but yet how effective they are at sustaining a slow burn when it comes to producing light.
And why is it? I mean, you mentioned there that the gas is burning from the wax. Why is it that some things are more flammable than others?
There's another great question. When you're sitting at home and you're looking at the iron stove in your sitting room and you're thinking about the wood inside that's burning, I think, well, why does the wood burn but the iron that the fire is made out of doesn't burn? It's a good question,
yeah.
Right? You know, it's just like, is everything flammable? The answer is yes. You can heat everything up to a certain point and it will catch fire. But the molecules that are in wood, made out of carbon, cellulose, right? They're much easier to disrupt than a metal, because when you heat up a metal is able to distribute the heat that you give it very effectively. So the whole thing warms up rather slowly. If you take something like cellulose that's in wood and you heat it up, the edges will get very hot very fast. It won't be able to dissipate the heat. And so the edge of the piece of wood will catch fire. And when you look at a very close level at a piece of wood that's burning, in fact, what's happening is you're taking a very thin edge of the wood and you're turning it into a gas, and that gas goes on fire.
Mm-hmm. And you were talking about, you know, looking at flames and how fascinating it is. And they're often orange or perhaps yellow, but then fireworks are all sorts of colours.
Yeah.
So what's going on there? What's the difference between the firework and the flame?
We had a long journey home from Cork yesterday in the car, and I was chatting to my wife about coming on the show. She was amazed that not everything, when I was telling her that not everything burns yellow, right? And so a lot of things when you set them on fire burn yellow, and that just tells you about what it's made out of. But you can set other things on fire and they'll give a different colour. And scientists are able to use this technique to identify what's in things by setting them on fire. So you think about basic fireworks, you could put an element like copper in there. You set copper on fire, it goes green. It's like the Wizard of Oz. Or lithium will go a brick red. And you can make combinations of fireworks that have different elements in them. You set them on fire and they will give a spectrum of colour. And as I said, scientists use this technique. It's called spectroscopy. So when we look out into the universe and we look at the light that comes from distant stars, we're able to tell what those stars are made of by the colour of the light that they give off. We never have to go there to know what they're made out of.
Extraordinary.
Isn't that absolutely extraordinary? When I shouldn't say that on national radio, but one day if we discover that there is alien life, it'll most likely be due to a spectroscopic technique. We'll be looking for signals in distant atmospheres, and we can do this, like exoplanets that are thousands of light years away. We'll be able to look and see what their atmospheres are made out of, and we may be able to distinguish elements that are in their atmospheres that would be absolutely indicative of life.
Were you about to say when we discover alien
life? I reckon, even though the universe is enormous, I reckon it is probably within my lifetime that we will discover that life could be possible in other places. Mm-hmm. We look at Mars at the moment. There's numerous missions that are being sent to Mars to look for the fossilized remains of life. Because when Mars and the Earth were formed billions of years ago, both had the perfect conditions for life to form on them. And of course, Mars lost its atmosphere. And so life, if it was there, would have died out. But it had all the conditions, the right amount of heat. It had liquid water, etc. So life may have taken hold there. If it has taken hold in more than one place, it's quite likely that other solar systems in the universe would have had the right conditions for life as well. So the conditions we will look for are spectroscopic. And the other one is what you do, Claire, mm-hmm. radio signals. Can right. we identify signals from distant planets that would be giving off basically radio signals that would identify them as intelligent?
Well, we're going off topic now.
We are.
But could the right conditions exist now somewhere else? In other words, could there be a mirror planet to Earth somewhere?
Well, mirror planet is a different question. Could the right conditions? Yes. Is that life intelligent? We don't know. There's a famous thing called the Drake equation, which works out the probability of there being another intelligent civilization out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been that in the universe, there's probably somewhere between 1 and 10 other civilizations out there that are like us. But we now realize, unfortunately, that clever species like ourselves are not as clever as we think, because the likelihood of us going extinct due to our own activities is increasing. So how long would an intelligent civilization last is the last piece of the Drake equation. So we may only exist for a flash in the timeline of the universe,
mm-hmm.
because we will do things like burn too many things,
yeah,
create
like
too much
combustion,
carbon dioxide.
Which,
exactly,
we're which
back
we're
to
talking
fire.
About today. Listen, come back to the fire for a minute, because when we cook with gas, we'll see a blue flame. Why is that? Why does gas burn blue?
Yeah, so when you cook at home with gas, you're using butane or propane, right? Of course, the stuff was like liquid, gasified gold during Storm Ione as people tried to get their hands on it. You're introducing oxygen there, and you're controlling the amount of oxygen you add into the chemical reaction. And if you burn those gases in a very rich oxygen environment, you get a blue flame. So you may remember in school playing with the Bunsen burner.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little thing at the bottom that controlled how much air was going into the Bunsen. As he fiddled with it, it went from a kind of a smoky yellow flame to a very hot, bright blue
because
flame.
Because more gas.
More oxygen.
Shane, always great to have you with us. Shane Bergen there from UCD. We're going to take a quick break. We'll do that now.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.